Welcome to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd. Today it's bird news, and with us is Mark Faraday, who, in addition to hosting the weekly bird report on CAI, is the science coordinator at Mass Audubon Cape Cod. Hello, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Amy.
Let's start with rare bird sightings. Tell us more about what folks are seeing out at Race Point and around Provincetown.
Well, always good pretty much any time of year, and worth the effort to get out there usually for interesting birds. Race Point is actually really good this time of year, even when other places are a little quieter. It's just like Grand Central Station for seabirds in particular. I mean, you can see things that you would normally have to be on a boat to see. Sooty shearwaters, great shearwaters, you know, both of which are coming from the southern hemisphere. Wilson storm petrels coming from down near Antarctica as well. Manx shearwaters, which come from the northern hemisphere. And there's always the potential for rarities. And of course, staging terns now. There's a big flock of staging terns who finish breeding common terns and also roseate terns. And beautiful, elegant, federally endangered terns that mostly nest closer to you there in Buzzards Bay, a couple of islands in Buzzards Bay. But now it's getting to be the end of breeding season, and so things are dispersing, and the birding is really getting good everywhere now. So the big news at Race Point, though, was not a seabird. It was just an absolutely bizarre, unexpected, but the kind of thing that is on brand for Race Point. And so one of the usual birders up there, Peter Flood, was doing one of his typical vigils. He'll spend 8 hours there out at the race, like where you have to walk 2 miles to get out there or drive out on the beach. And he sees all of the gulls get up. And when the terns are very skittish and flighty, you know, I saw them chasing vultures and things the other day. But the gulls usually don't respond unless it's something like a bald eagle. And so all the gulls got up in terror. And he's like, oh, it must be a bald eagle. But no, it was a crested caracara. So this is a bird. The closest place you can see this bird, this non-migratory, it's a weirdo of a bird, right? It's supposedly a falcon. It doesn't look anything like a falcon. It has rounded wings. It sort of looks like a hawk. It's got long legs. It's mostly a South American bird, but they breed in Central Florida ranch country in like cabbage palm trees, where, you know, in cattle pastures. That's the closest place you would find a crested caracara. And they're weird. You know, they have black and white head and red on them, and they're very distinctive birds, kind of lanky, long tail. But it's, you know, it looks like a hawk or an eagle. And so all the gulls got up. And I can't imagine what Peter was thinking. In his very understated sort of deadpan sense of humor, he's like, well, I thought maybe it was an eagle, but it was just a crested caracara. It's like the third record ever for the Cape. Just absolutely crazy. And the time of year makes no sense. It's a non-migratory bird. You know, the correct time to expect the crested caracara on the Cape is never. And the expected number is zero, right? It's like, what? But that's just what makes birding on the Cape so fun. You just never know. You just can't believe these things. And who knows how it ended up out over the water and coming in at Race Point. And it stayed at least through Sunday. And people refound it. They went to the Province Lands Visitor Center, where you have that commanding view of the dunes out there. And they found it just sitting in a pitch pine. And it flew around a little bit. It's maybe has moved on, or you know, people didn't rediscover it yesterday, as far as I know. But yeah, be on the lookout for that. They like open areas, and they'll just sit at the top of a low tree in an open area. So I don't know. People were saying maybe crane.
Oh yeah,
farm somewhere. Mm-hmm. Edge of a salt marsh. Yeah, be on the lookout. Look it up, because it's an interesting looking bird. It's distinctive. You wouldn't mistake it for like a red-tailed hawk or something.
And it's a bird of prey, right? So it might probably does want to get that back to the sort of?
Right. So they describe it as it looks like a hawk. It acts like a vulture, but it's supposedly a falcon. And it, you know, they eat dead things. Mm-hmm. I think they do a certain amount of catching their own food, but they're scavengers. And if you look at their range, it's like much of South America. Caracaras are South America. There are other species down there too, but this is the one that gets up into the very southern parts of the US. So yeah, just such a weird bird, and then so weird for it to be here on top of that. And so birders got all excited, and everybody was heading out there. I was out in that area on Sunday, but didn't see it. I was doing a butterfly count, and just kind of looking out for it, but unfortunately I did not bump into the crested Caracara.
Now, are there, and maybe you don't want to give away your sources, but are there sort
But
of, chats, or how do you birders keep track of where it might be seen next? Or again, like, is that just texting, or is there sort of a more official channel to keep track of where
yeah, it's
these
a
are?
secret society.
I thought it might
We would
be.
have to beat you into it. Right? There's hazing. Yeah. No. Right. And so it's changed over the years. When I got out of college, it was email listservs, right? The old listservs, Massbird. And that still exists. And a lot of people still use Massbird. But really, for the instant communication, there are two main sources. GroupMe, the texting app, is what most people are using now, and there's been this proliferation of hyper-local GroupMes. There's like two for the Capes for some reason, and then Discord, which younger people like. There's also a Discord. It's another app, another communication app. But yeah, those are the main things, and social media is not the best way. Birds make it onto social media, but it's not the way that it gets instantly communicated, where you're calling out the cavalry that there's a rare bird somewhere.
Right. And you also mentioned there's a Caribbean species of tern that's been making friends with people and dogs on the Cape and South Shore. What's up with this one?
Oh, good Lord. This is such a cool, fun story, and also so strange, right? I just like Some weeks I'm like, what am I going to write about this week? Chickadees? I don't know. And then some weeks it's just like, how do I connect these two crazy big ornithological stories that happened in the same week? They have no connection. So the bridal tern is a Caribbean species. It's just one of the warm water terns. And we have our common terns and roseate terns and these. We have our cold water, locally breeding terns. But then there are these warm water species of tern that are very different. And so in the US, if you were to go to the dry Tortugas, which are, you would take a ferry from Key West, and it's way not, like, it's technically in the US, but it's closer to Cuba than it is to, Miami. And so there's a nesting colony there of bridal terns and sooty terns, which are similar, and some other kind of tropical seabirds. But they behave differently than our terns. The only bridal tern I've ever seen in Massachusetts was like way out, 150 miles south of Hyannis, at the canyons where you get warm water and people fish for marlin and you can see whale sharks and things like that. But due to a technicality, you're still in Massachusetts waters. And I saw one. They're famous for standing on flotsam, like out in the middle of the ocean. Like there's nothing for miles and miles. And then you'll see one standing on a little piece of wood floating around on the ocean, bridal tern. They're very dark. They're bigger than our local terns, darker back, slower wing beats. So anyway, for some reason, there had been multiple bridal terns coming in off the Gulf Stream or away from the Sargasso Sea, where they would normally be. They're associated with sargassum, that kind of floating warm water seaweed, which you can see in like Woods Hole. And so there's one that's been going around the Gulf of Maine. There was a sighting at Race Point a few weeks ago, just by one birder, a fleeting sighting with no photo. But then during that storm, whenever that was in the last like week or so, people went to Ra I'm sorry, First Encounter Beach, that classic storm bird watching beach, and saw one. Made multiple passes there to the delight of all those birders. So this is a bird to see in Massachusetts. You either have to, like I said, go way out on one of those dedicated trips to the warm water canyons, or a hurricane. We only see them during hurricanes within sight of land, and even then rarely. And so the fact that just now there's one hanging out And so to sort of finish the story, this isn't the Cape, but up in Scituate Harbor, a bridal tern has settled in and it's just there every day. And I can't think of other rare birds that have ever turned up at Scituate Harbor. It's not like some hotspot, but it's landing on people's heads and it's playing with a Rottweiler and other dogs. It's like landing on them. And it's famous for landing on the backs of sea turtles and things like that, but routinely landing on people's cars, their heads, multiple people. There are all these photos and videos going around. So imagine you're going to see like the rarest bird in the state. Oh, I hope I see it. Maybe I'll just see it distantly in my scope. And then you see it on your scope. It's literally perching on your scope. There's pictures of it perching on people's camera lenses, scopes, lots of hats, and the occasional Rottweiler. Like this is like the dream rare bird, the friendliest. And then the whole thing with the Rottweiler, it's like a Disney movie. Like they're friends.
That's so strange.
And somebody found a report from North Carolina from just like 2 weeks ago, where somebody posted a picture of it sitting on their aunt's hat, or one, a bridal tern. Maybe it's this one.
Maybe
right?
The same one, yeah.
It's the friendliest bridal tern.
So
and they said, well, it was, so it would play with our dog. It would fly in and it would poke our dog and then get it to chase it. And then it came and it landed on my aunt's head. I swear this is real. There's a picture of it sitting on the aunt's head. And we in Massachusetts know that that's very real. Maybe it's that same tern, you know, and it's like, well, is it just naive or was it in rehab? Like, is it imprinted on humans because it was in a wildlife rehabilitation center in the Florida Keys, right, or something like that? I'm going to ask around a little bit, but I haven't been able to go deep yet on whether this is just kind of something they do, as I've never heard of it. Certainly, we don't ever get bridal terns just hanging around in the summer in calm weather. So cool.
And they're great. I mean, you sent some photos, but I'm sure if anyone does a Google search, you can see some images of it with and around the dog.
Right.
On social
and
media.
So I'm trying to research other examples of this, but this is dominating the news, the social media. If you Google like bridal tern dog, all of this stuff about the one in Scituate comes up. And I'm trying to see if there's any other examples of this happening in the past or the behavior literature or something like that. And everything that comes up is, you know, people have done podcasts about it and already just, you know, the way things work now, birding influencers. And so, yeah, just Google bridled, you know, bridled, like a bridal veil.
Yeah.
Bridal turn. My favorite comment about the one that's like landing on heads and playing with dogs was unbridled tern.
That's a good one.
It feels very free. It's unafraid.
We're talking birds, nature, and wildlife this hour with Mark Faraday. If you have a question, comment, or observation, you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vince, in for Mindy Todd, and it's our monthly bird news show with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon Cape Cod. If you have a question, comment, or observation about birds, wildlife, or the natural world, you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We got an email from Cindy who writes, I've lived in West Falmouth for over 35 years and have never seen a red squirrel. However, this year I've been seeing one for about a month under the bird feeder. Then on Sunday, there was a commotion on the driveway from some song sparrows. Turns out that the red squirrel had caught one of them and was under the car and then ran off with it. The birds were not happy. Anyway, what can you tell us about red squirrels?
Oh, I love red. Love me some red squirrels. They've got such attitude, yeah. Right? You know, I'm a short Irish guy. I understand. They're like a short redheaded squirrel. They've got a temper. but they're also predators, right? And this is something I talk about a lot, like bursting people's Disney bubbles about wildlife, right? It really is red nature, red in tooth and claw out there. And yes, a red squirrel is a nest predator. A chipmunk is a nest predator. A white-hooded mouse is a nest predator. And so, you know, everything's just out there trying to stay alive, get some nutrition. And so, yeah, I'm not surprised by that. It's not something I see a lot. I mostly have read about it, but I'm aware of it, from the literature and whatever else. But red squirrels, if you don't see them much, you probably don't have tons of pine forest right there. Even with all of our pine forest that kind of dominates this region, red squirrels aren't like everywhere. We certainly see them at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary. If you go to our feeder windows, you'll see both red and gray squirrels, but they're just conifer specialists. So anywhere you go, and the further north you go, the more conifers there are, and the more red squirrels you see. But I've read that they have been known to prey on baby bunnies.
Wow. They're
And I learned,
They're not much bigger than a baby bunny.
no,
They're smaller
well,
than the
right.
gray squirrels, right? Aren't they typically
They're
smaller?
smaller than the gray squirrels, but yeah, they're bigger than tiny little, baby bunnies. But I don't know how big of a baby bunny they'll go after. But when you think of predators like weasels, the least weasel is tiny. It's like smaller than a chipmunk, but it's a predator. It's eating mice. And I had short-tailed shrews, just keeping on this theme of things you thought were cute that were deadly. Short-tailed shrews, one of my favorite animals in the world. And I use it as a reason to keep leaf litter around, like leave leaves on the ground permanently, not just like for the winter, but just like have areas where you just leave the leaves on the ground always year round, because they are strongly associated with it. And they're little predators, short-tailed shrew, tiny. They're not rodents. Shrews are not rodents. They have high metabolism. They mostly eat meat. They're hunting worms and invertebrates under the leaves year round. And I had them preying on a rabbit nest in my border garden where I left the leaves. And because I left the leaves, the rabbits nested there, and then the shrews were there. And it was all happening under the leaves, but I know what they were doing. They think I don't know. And yeah, I mean, and I was hearing squeals from the baby
Oh my
bunnies, and then
goodness.
seeing, oftentimes you have to infer that the shrew is there by the movement of the leaves,
Right.
because they don't like to be seen. You'll see them like scampering across an open area just to like get back under the leaves on the other side. It's one of the reasons I love them. But yeah, so it's open season on baby things out there right now.
I never would have expected. All right, we
Yeah.
have a call from Cynthia from Worcester. Hello, Cynthia, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Oh, okay, great. Hi, good morning. Is this Mindy?
No,
Mindy and
it's Amy. Amy with Mark.
oh,
Mindy.
Amy.
Mindy's on
Amy.
vacation.
Just as good.
And yeah. Okay, well, I won't keep you too long, but I've been having a lot of beautiful sightings. But the most beautiful sighting I had was right here in Elm Park in Worcester, where at one time I saw five piping plovers, and they flew over. And I'm like, wow, that's a shorebird. What's that shorebird doing so far inland? Is that a common thing or unusual or?
No, that's I'm this is where I come off like a
Yeah, I
jerk.
mean,
That's
I
not
have
what they were. I'm
lately.
almost certainly not what they were. There's no way. So there's semi-pommated plovers, look just like a piping plover and will turn up like there are shorebirds that shorebirds spend a lot of time inland. Just in general, if a reservoir gets drawn down during shorebird migration, shorebirds will end up there. Like they're flying over, and if they see good habitat, mud flats, flooded farm fields, most in the spring, most shorebirds go straight up through the middle of the continent, and they're stopped in flooded farm fields and mud puddles and things in like Kansas and Texas and like nowhere near the coast. And we don't even see that many shorebirds in spring because they're going in like real inland, like the middle of the country, the flyover states.
I thought that they were
And
probably
so they're
migrating, but
so mo
I have seen one kind of hanging around. I haven't seen five altogether, but I have seen this one. I haven't seen it in the last few days, but there has been one that it looks like a killdeer because it cut the two stripes.
yeah, exactly.
But they seem to
Yes.
be hanging around. I'm thinking, well,
Killdeer.
they must be here to keep them here, so.
Well, they killdeer breed inland, and so they've historically bred in like river valleys and things. They're not a coastal species. They will nest at a beach sometimes, but killdeer is a good example of a shorebird that nests inland and is like all across the continent, not just at the coast. And so that's normal. It probably bred there or is may still be. And then things like semi-palmated plovers will land inland sometimes. Certainly least sandpipers, which we see here at the coast, they're often in freshwater wetlands in migration. And a lot of the other ones too, especially if they get grounded by fog or something like that. And a lot of the inland birders who it's a long drive for them to get to the coast, they really appreciate when weather downs some of the usual coastal shorebirds at places like, Wachusett Reservoir or something like that. But they weren't
Okay. Well,
piping plover. Piping
I'm
plovers
so excited
don't do
to
that.
see them.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Cynthia. Thanks
Okay.
for
Thank you
listening.
very much.
We are talking about birds, nature, and wildlife this hour with Mark Faraday. If you have a question or comment, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org.
Just before I
Oh, go ahead.
just before I just need to cl so people are anyone who really knows piping plovers well might be screaming at their radio. There are inland populations of piping plovers that are way more endangered than our certainly than in our Massachusetts ones in terms of the numbers. They're all listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act, but there's a very small Great Lakes population of piping plovers where you go to the Great Lakes in Chicago and there's dunes, it looks like here. And there are some piping plovers that nest on Great Lakes and then like rivers in North Dakota, Missouri River, places like that, there are river breeding populations of piping plovers and least terns. But so they are obviously flying over the interior at times to get to the Gulf Coast and wherever else they winter. But I'm almost certain this would have been something else. They don't like turn up in Worcester.
And when you say
So
fly,
anyway.
when you say flying over, for birds who are doing that long migration, are they staying at altitude until they arrive at their destination? They're not stopping along the way, like a piping plover isn't, excuse me, stopping, are they?
Well, most things that migrate stop along the way, but if it's not suitable habitat, they're gonna do everything in their power to keep going. And so they'll fly day and night. If they don't need to stop, they will fly day and night unless they are forced down by weather or they need to refuel and they see some suitable place. Right? That's why we get so many good birds here, because they keep flying and flying, and then a wind will put them out over the ocean where they don't want to be. They get to the point where they need to stop. They're going to orient back to land. And what's the nearest land? If you're out over the Gulf of Maine, it's often Cape Cod. But yeah, they like to keep going, especially like seabird, like so loons. There's a migration of loons and sea ducks from Alaska, where they have to get to this coast. They're flying over the vast interior of Canada, and trying to get to salt water, and so there are long stretches where they don't want to stop.
They don't want
I
to
mean,
stop.
they can. There's a million lakes they could put down in if they wanted to, but for the most part, they're getting up high and just trying to make time.
Right. Get to the destination as fast as they can.
Yep.
As you know, the radio station is now located up in Beebe Woods in Falmouth, and it was probably late April I was walking around in the woods, and on the same walk I saw a great horned owl fly in front of me and then perch on a
Oh.
tree, which was unexpected. And then on the same walk, I saw a brilliant red bird. And this was before the oaks had leafed out, so it was easy to see through the trees. And it was a scarlet tanager, which I had never seen before. And I remember years ago, I think I saw an eastern towhee for the first time, and I was so excited. And Vern Locks was like, "Yeah, that's a really common bird. So what are you so excited about that for?" But I wondered
Right.
about the scarlet tanager. How common are they in this region?
Yeah, they're more common down the upper Cape, where there tends to be richer, more mature forest, like that forest. And so, yeah, for that open house event where I was leading bird walks for the radio station, I back on was Saturday, June 13th. And I was leading these bird walks, and I'm like, oh boy, it's a hot afternoon. Like, what better time to lead bird walk than a hot, sleepy afternoon? But there were two scarlet tanagers. One was calling and another was singing, so I know they're in there. And I heard one in Truro on Sunday. They get really scarce when you get to the Outer Cape. But say from like Brewster West in any of the richer forest, there are lots of scarlet tanagers. And one place where there are tons of scarlet tanagers that doesn't seem to make a ton of sense, but it's a testament to the good land management they do there, is Camp Edwards. So they do a lot of prescribed burning and mechanical treatments to keep the open habitats open as pine barrens should be, right? Pine barrens should have a lot of open pine savanna. And we wouldn't be having this issue with the southern pine beetle if we managed our pine barrens better with prescribed burning and things like that. And they do that in there. They do exemplary pine barrens management. And somehow those pine savannas are full of scarlet tanagers, in addition to the other things they're managing for, like whippoorwills and grasshopper sparrows and things like that. There are lots of scarlet tanagers on the military base, which they're getting kind of the best of both worlds with their management.
Well, we have a couple of calls on the line where it's here from John, who's calling in from Chatham. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I have a bird behavior question that actually took place in Connecticut, but I'm sure it would be interesting to your viewers. I was fly fishing on a stream, and I heard a big noise behind me, and I thought it was a bear or something going in the water. And I see a bald eagle departing from the stream. I didn't think too much of it. And then a half an hour later or so, I see a bald eagle again with a big stick, bigger than it would seem it would use for nesting, who drops it into the stream. And I wondered if eagles, if you've ever heard, would eagles do that to move fish and see if there are fish in the stream?
Oh, interesting theory. I have no idea. I've never heard of that. What time of year was
Nor have
this?
I. This was springtime, this spring.
What month? It doesn't actually matter that
I
much. So
think in May, but it was interesting. I had never heard of that myself either.
So my guess is it was its eyes were bigger than its muscles, and it was thinking about adding it to its nest, and it was too heavy for it. Because they'll spruce up their nest, year round to some extent. Like certainly throughout the nesting period, when they're using the nest and they have chicks in it and things, they will periodically add sticks to it. You see ospreys doing the same thing. So yeah, I don't think it was like evolving into a beaver. Like, oh, if I turn this into a pond, it'll be easier to catch the fish. I don't think they're thinking thinking ahead in that way. That's my guess. But maybe I'm underestimating eagles. Maybe they're secretly working with the beavers to dam streams to make it easier to catch fish.
John, thanks for the call. On that same subject, eagles, we have an email from Spruce on Nantucket who says, I'm wondering why eagles are not nesting on Nantucket. We have had flyovers and individual adults and juveniles, but no nests. So, Mark, I want you to conjure up your inner eagle and enlighten us. Thank you.
Yeah, I think the rent's too damn high. Yeah, no, that's a good question because they're colonizing. I mean, it's not like there are tons of them nesting on the Cape. We only know of three nests. I'm sure there are more. I guarantee you there are more than that, but we only know about three. They're weirdly hard to find, but it would be hard to hide an eagle nest on Nantucket. I mean, for one thing, there's not a lot of mature forest. You don't have the kinds of like wooded lakes that we have here on the Cape. And there's a fraction of the number of ospreys on Nantucket compared to the vineyard. And so it's just not as, maybe not as inviting yet to big fish-eating birds, but they could certainly, an enterprising pair of eagles will probably try to take over an osprey nest on Nantucket at some point, or find a big pine and it'll probably happen. Yeah, but they seem to be nesting on the vineyard now. I've lost track. They've been attempting it multiple times. I'm trying to remember if they've been successful yet. Maybe someone can, without revealing the location or whatever, maybe someone from the vineyard can call in and remind me
Let us
what's going
know.
on with eagles there. But yeah, we do have three known nest sites that people are aware of and the state is aware of. Eastham, Brewster, and Barnstable are the three towns. But there's got to be more somewhere in Falmouth, Mashpee, Wakeby area. There have to be others.
Thanks for the call. We also have Rick on the line calling in from Eastham. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. I was wondering if there are any birds that eat the greenhead flies that we see in the summer all along the beaches and the marshes. Do those greenheads have any predators?
Yes. Not enough, as we know, right? I've been doing salt marsh bird surveys the last month or so, just getting hammered. I had to wear shorts because I was wading across a creek to get out to one of the sites, and I'm just like a sitting duck out there, right? Blood on the legs, they're brutal. And so the important predators of a fly like that would be things that eat the larvae. And whatever's eating the larvae, that would have to be happening down in the mud. I know less about that. But there is one, and I see swallows flying low over the marshes. I've seen our purple martins that nest at Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary, and they normally forage very high, higher than tree swallows and barn swallows, the smaller swallows. And they eat big things like dragonflies and big moths and butterflies sometimes. But I've been seeing them pretty regularly low over the marshes in Wellfleet, where, boy, hopefully, God, please, they're eating greenheads. But there is something that you might not think of that eats greenheads, and that's a really cool wasp. And I try to be a PR person for wasps because they're all beneficial. Like, there's no, unless it's stinging you. People think of yellow jackets and the last time they got stung, but yellow jackets are not normal wasps. Most wasps are harmless and solitary, and they're just out there doing the job of eating other insects, like thousands of species of wasps, tiny things, big things, parasitic ones. And there's a wasp called the American sand wasp. It's like Bembyx americana. It's a beautiful wasp, and you'll see it visiting flowers in your garden. It's like blue and black striped abdomen, like big green eyes. They're cool, very cool looking. And they're eating greenheads. They're catching adult greenheads and feeding them to their larvae. They themselves, adult wasps don't eat meat, but they feed meat to their babies, right? They're feeding caterpillars and grasshoppers and tarantulas, in the case of one in the Southwest, literally catching and paralyzing tarantulas, carrying it off like a helicopter, putting it in a nest for its larvae to eat. And around here we have spider wasps, so they're eating all kinds of other invertebrates at the larval stage. And so yeah, there might be a if you were to open up a sand wasp nest, you'd probably find it full of greenheads.
That's a great PSA for.
I wonder
Yeah,
how
yeah.
the wasps catch the greenheads, because according to my picture insect app on the phone, the greenheads go 90 miles an hour.
Yeah, well, they could catch them very easily by picking them off my legs. They're not moving then.
All right. Rick, thanks so much for the call. It is Bird News this hour. We are talking with Mark Faraday. We're talking birds, nature, and wildlife. If you have a question, comment, or observation, you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vince in for Mindy Todd, and it's our monthly bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon Cape Cod. If you have a question or comment or observation about birds, wildlife, or the natural world, you can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We have Kurt I have a quick one for you, Mark. I have been hearing in my yard for almost the entire summer what I think is a red-tailed hawk. I'm pretty sure it's a red-tailed hawk, but it seems to be calling repeatedly all day long. So I'll leave in the morning and I'll hear it, and then I'll come home in the afternoon and I'll hear it, and it just is constant. So I'm wondering, do you think that's a young in a nest? Do you think there's a nest there? Do red-tailed hawks typically just hang out in the trees and call? What do you think? Do you have any ideas?
Yeah, right. Not only when they're young. Yeah. So I think this time of year you get fledgling hawks that are noisy. They're, think of ospreys. Sometimes there are ospreys that people call them in because they're just calling and calling, and they seem so pitiable. They're like, why won't my parents feed me anymore? It's at that difficult period in a young bird's life when the adults stop bringing them food and they have to figure things out for themselves. And they may end up in your backyard and they're just like, feed me, right? But the adults are starting to practice tough love, and at a certain point they don't bring them food anymore. But young hawks can be very noisy, and I, without hearing a recording, young hawks make ambiguous sounds that don't necessarily sound like the adults, but
we
if
do
I
have
heard
a
quick recording, I could tell you.
Okay, well, we have a recording. Let's see if Elsa. Ooh.
Yeah, that's a red tail. Funny, I'm realizing that's a red-tailed hawk call that blue jays imitate a lot. Blue jays constantly do that call. Like, that's a hawk. I'm not saying yours is a blue jay, but that's a call. If you listen to blue jays, that's one they do a lot. And they do that one better than they do the adult red-tailed hawk call. Blue jays imitate every hawk. Broad-winged, red-shouldered, they're brilliant at those. Osprey, I've heard them do. Cooper's hawk, they're really good at. But for some reason, the most common hawk, red-tailed hawk, they struggle with that adult call. It's never very convincing. But everything else, I can't tell the difference between a blue jay and the actual hawk.
That's impressive.
But they are good at, again, they are good at imitating the young, annoying young begging red-tailed hawks like that.
Unfortunately, I guess we have one in our neighborhood. Okay, let's turn to Kurt, who is calling in from Truro. Good morning, Kirk. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Amy. Hello, Mark. I have a question about robins and their cooperation with other birds. Like, I think they were house sparrows or song sparrows. So we had a robin nest over a door with a trellis attached to it. And yesterday we heard a horrible kerfuffle outside, and we noticed that there not only were the pair of robins, but there were a couple of other robins, and there were sparrows, and we thought they were fighting. Further investigation, someone went outside, and I'm glad it wasn't me, went out and found a huge racer snake, and what we surmised was the racer snake went up and got the babies, and then came down, and the birds were going after it, and it actually caught one of the parent robins too. A horrible scene. But we're all wondering about the cooperation about different species of birds in, attacking or warning about this snake that was very predatory.
Yeah, right. And it's as simple as birds mob predators. And most famously, birders take advantage of this we'll play a screech owl call if we're doing some sort of a survey, like a Christmas bird count, or, birders will do it just to bring the birds closer so they can see them. But if you play a screech owl call, particularly in the winter, all the chickadees and nuthatches and titmice and woodpeckers and pine warblers and everything else, they'll all come in. And it sort of builds. They're attracted to the alarm calls of the other birds, and they all come in to see what's going on. It's seems like morbid curiosity. Like, why would they come towards a predator is what people always ask. But the predator is not dangerous if everybody knows about it, right? Because a bird is much faster than these other things. They can stay away from it if they're not stupid, like that robin that got too close to the business end of the racer. But that's the idea. It's like, whether they're an individual bird is just like, bah, I'm freaking out, there's a predator, and it sort of builds from there, and then everybody's aware of it.
I see.
The freaking out attracts other birds. So it's not like cooperative. It's just kind of like, ah, a snake, you know, and then all of a sudden the whole neighborhood's in on it. And it's a good way to find owls and snakes and things like that. You know, you hear birds going crazy, right? If you are familiar with sort of the background level of bird noise in your neighborhood, and then you hear like it. So another common example is if you hear crows going absolutely ballistic, like losing their minds, that's a great horned owl. If they're sort of worked up, it's probably a red-tailed hawk. You know, there's a sound that blue jays do if they're getting chased by a Cooper's hawk. There's a whole like language of birds out there, like telling you about predators. There's something that chickadees do. They will go really high pitched, like dog whistle of a call. That's not one of their normal sounds if there's a predator around.
I see.
So yeah, there are all kinds of behaviors around this, but yeah, boy, that robin just lost its mind. I guess it just was overcome with grief and threw itself into the mouth of the snake or something like that. But that's a that's classic.
Do you think that snake could have gone up the trellis and the rose bush into the nest?
Absolutely. Yeah, racers. Yeah. Okay. So black racer, and you said you were in Truro. So on the Outer Cape, black racer is considered like a declining species of kind of open and shrubby habitats over much of the state. But they're very common. They're pretty common on the Outer Cape. Like I almost stepped on one in Truro on Sunday. That's the most common snake you would see at, say, Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary. So we have a lot of encounters with them. Like I've seen them in a bush having just eaten like three catbird chicks, you know, 5 feet up in a bush. So that's pretty, pretty routine for them.
Kurt,
somebody's got to do it.
Thanks.
Otherwise, we'd be armpit deep in birds, right?
Thanks for the call, Kurt. Although I don't know if I really like the image of the snake climbing up after critters, but I guess that is part of the natural world.
Right.
We have Michelle joining us from the South Shore. Good morning, Michelle.
Hi. I'm just going to turn down my radio here. Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, perfect. So I have a hummingbird feeder in my yard, and we've had hummingbirds coming, you know, starting in May through October every year. And this is the first time I see what looks like a black-chinned hummingbird. So it has a purple patch below its chin. It's quite dark on the back, on the wing area in the head, and it has purple under its chin. And when I looked up in my book that might be outdated, it said it should be from the on the opposite coast. So I'm wondering, is it common for these to be sighted on our side of the United States, or is it just lost its way? Is it like an individual?
Well, no, it would be extremely rare. I don't know if there'd be any summer records. I think there might have been a summer record. But if there's any way you can photograph this bird, like from multiple angles, multiple light, you know, to show that it really does have that purple throat and get it to me, it would be remarkable. Black-chinned hummingbird is the Western U.S. counterpart of a ruby-throated hummingbird. And the only difference, you can't tell the females apart, or like you can't, I can't just by quickly looking. And the only difference in the males, and often males of both species, the throats just look dark because the color is not made by pigment. It's made by the angle of the light, the refraction of the light through the special feathers. And so they have to be facing the right way relative to the sun for you to even see what color the chin is. And so you'd have to you'd really have to get it right in photographing. But if it's coming repeatedly, please do that.
Right.
Like call someone you know with a telephoto lens. Where is this again?
Right. Specifically in Easton, Easton.
I know Easton. I'm from Brockton. A lot of off Cape calls today. I like it.
Yeah. Right. And so I also noticed that the feathers on the wings were a bit darker than So we often get female ruby-throated, and only this year did I actually see a an actual male come, and that's a bright red on the throat. But this was a so I wasn't sure what I was seeing, and I actually had my husband come out, and he brought his phone out to take a picture. But they're so fast that by the time he's pressing the buttons, it's gone, you know. But so I'm thinking that probably a telephoto lens or something has to be incorporated because they are quick.
I mean, it may turn out to be. I'm looking right now. I just looked it up in eBird, which is, you know, where people report bird sightings. And there's a lot of old data that in it now. And I just looked up black-chinned hummingbird records, June and July throughout history. And this, the entire eastern U.S. is blank, except for one.
Okay.
One of the Great Lakes, there's some anomalous record in 2017. I don't think it has any photos or anything, but accept it.
Yeah,
so that's how rare we're talking.
Michelle, yeah. if you can get a picture as best you can, send it to the point at capeandislands.org, and we can get it onto Mark, and yeah, it'll be great to see it. Thanks so much for sharing that.
Awesome. I'll keep an eye out and I'll try to do that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I have another.
Put Easton on the rare bird map.
Okay, that's
get a
right.
Lot of, we'll get a lot of stuff in Easton.
Okay, I have one other little audio clip here that I want to have you give a listen. So I was walking out at the Cape Cod Rod and Gun Club in Wacoit. I don't know if it's near the Childs River. There's some restored cranberry bogs out there. And
yes.
It was about 8 a.m. and I heard this sound.
What bird is that?
Exactly. And of course, I feel silly because I did get the Merlin bird app and it was saying finding no birds. So I assume it's some sort of tree frog, but it was just this chorus of frogs all around me.
Yeah, good for you. Yes, it's gray tree frog. It's one of my favorite sounds. It's a sound of summer. And it's just a hot summer day. You'll hear that from the trees. Often like really far from water. You're like, what? Where do they breed? Like, how did this thing get here? It can't fly. Like, why is it hundreds and hundreds of yards from any kind of standing water? But it's such a great sound that I love it. But yeah, gray tree frog.
Oh.
It's our only tree frog, really. Peepers are not tree frogs. They're like chorus frogs, a different group of frogs. But and they're more like shrub frogs. But gray tree frog is our one true tree frog. And they're relatively recent to the Outer Cape. They didn't used to be out here so much, but they seem to be getting more common out here now. I love them.
I'll have to look up an image of that to see how big are they?
Smaller than, bigger than a peeper, smaller than like a green frog, way smaller than a bullfrog.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll have to look that up. That
yeah,
really
you know,
fun.
If you ever see, I don't know what people know for frogs, but if you ever see a wood frog, they're like about that size, but kind of flatter, more tree frog looking with suctiony toes.
Got it. We just have about 30 seconds left, but maybe you can't fit any of this in, but I'm thinking that there are some birds that have already wrapped up sort of the nesting and the rearing and maybe are even thinking about the fall migration, or is it still a little bit too early for that?
No. I mean, July is when migration starts for all kinds of things, right? And in terms of like shorebirds, Arctic nesting shorebirds, like they're full on migrating now.
Wow.
Like the floodgates are starting to open and you could see flocks of 100 short-billed dowitchers and willets are flocking up now as they finish up breeding around here. Semi-palmated plovers, sandpipers, lee sandpipers are in. But then somebody was up at Nauset Bay in Eastham and they saw a rose-breasted grosbeak fly in off the water. At a young one, right? So even songbirds are starting to move a little bit. And so it's time to
Sorry
think about
to put
that.
A damper on summer, but it's over. I'm just kidding.
That's right.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us. Mark Faraday from Mass Audubon Cape Cod. I'm Amy Vincent from Indie Todd. Thanks for listening.